Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ana Georgescu, and welcome to the New Books in Science podcast. Today's guest is Slobodan Perovic, author of From Data to Quanta, Niels Bohr's Vision of Physics, published by the University of Chicago Press in September of last year. It is a broad and insightful analysis of the renowned Niels Bohr's approach to physics, taking into account the historical context, the existing paradigms surrounding research, and the effects it had on the scientific community and beyond. Slobodan Perovic is a professor of the history and philosophy of science at the University of Belgrade. His work has been featured in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Studies in History and Philosophy of Modern Physics, Foundations of Science, and many more. Professor Perovic, it's great to have you today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's dive right in. In the introduction of your book, you describe the main goal as, and I quote, that of advancing a methodological understanding of Bohr's work through a historically motivated philosophical assessment of the scientific method as a constant and vigorous interplay between theory and experiment in the early development of quantum physics. That's quite a thesis. What drew your attention to Bohr's views specifically?
At the beginning, I wasn't really drawn to Bohr. As sort of the leading figure, it was just sort of part of my interests. What really drew me into the history and philosophy of early quantum mechanics was a book by Thomas Kuhn when I was a graduate student. And it was a book about the black body theory. It's actually titled Black Body Theory and Quantum Discontinuity, published, I believe, in 1978. So for those who are not philosophers or historians of physics or don't read that stuff, Thomas Kuhn is one of the major figures in the second half of the 20th century, and famous for his theory of scientific revolutions and the way that scientific revolutions developed. But this was not really the book that's at least directly related to that work. It's sort of a seminal and very well-known work across disciplines. This book outlined the first phase, or sort of a prequel to the development of quantum mechanics that occurred at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. It sort of dealt with the major puzzle at the time, which was called the ultraviolet catastrophe. So just very simply and briefly, physicists couldn't really figure out how to overcome the practically theoretical problem that if you treat atoms as oscillators and then you sort of account for, you know, their absorption and the radiation of energy by looking at the frequency at which they oscillate, they would always get sort of infinite values for the outgoing energy values of the so-called black body, so the body that ideally radiates all the energy that it absorbs. And then Max Planck, at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, offered his what he thought was sort of a tentative solution, kind of a model, a trick of sorts, to quantize energy and to say that energy can be emitted and absorbed only in sort of a quanta of energy. And that, of course, sounded strange, but it worked in terms of equations and results. And Thomas Kuhn really writes about this particular sort of string of events in the history of physics that led to this episode and then sort of start of the development of quantum mechanics. So I was completely impressed and mesmerized by the detailed account and also by that episode. And I started basically looking at the history of early quantum mechanics, having in mind my philosophical interests, because I'm really a philosopher of science. I was interested how major theories in physics came about, and was there a sort of a unifying method by means of which physicists arrived at these theories, and how these theories were related exactly to the experiments, or maybe there were more methods and so on. So then I tried to address these questions by looking at early quantum mechanics and its history. And then I realized that Niels Bohr, who was one of a few major figures with major results in that period, was kind of controversial, actually, among philosophers, among many physicists, too. And that was also kind of intriguing. And then I sort of went on to try and figure out why was he controversial and what exactly was driving him to these major results that he came up with, and whether there was a kind of a unifying method, sort of a, if you wish, technique that sort of led him to all this. So that was sort of the beginning of of all these interests.
So for our listeners who need a quick refresher on physics, Niels Bohr is obviously a very big name, but would you mind going over the three main contributions you focus on in the book? The atomic model, the principle of correspondence, and the principle of complementarity. Just give us a little bit of an overview of what these are.
Sure. So, I mean, if we would grade them in terms of the importance and in terms of the sort of level of the breakthrough, they're probably sort of the first one is the most important one. The second one is sort of less, a little less important. And then the third one is, I mean, if we would really have to sort of do that. And I kind of say that in the book. So the atom of the model that Bohr came up with or sort of constructed was really a big breakthrough, because at the time there were other models of the atom, but none of them were really aiming at very precise quantitative agreement with the evidence or with the experimental results, and especially not with a number of key experimental results. So it was a very ambitious model. And prior to that, there was J.J. Thomson's famous experimentalist, another one, Ernst Rutherford, and Bohr worked in both of their labs. So Thomson did the experiments with scattering of light, and then he realized that actually something that was sort of counterintuitive at the time, that atom is not a solid structure, a whole, so to speak, but there's a sort of a structure, internal structure to it, based on the results of scattering that he produced, and light scattering. And then he basically came up with a sort of a plum pudding, as it's usually characterized, model, where you have sort of charges floating around the sort of pudding, so to speak. Then Rutherford did his experiments, looked at some other related experiments, and then concluded that it's more structured, that it seems that the nucleus, the positive charge, is in the at the center, and then that the electrons are kind of floating around. And as I said, these were sort of very helpful models, but they were kind of qualitative models. There were some other models of the atom too. And then Bohr did a few remarkable things to arrive at that model that looks like a planetary system that many of us encountered in high school, where the nucleus is at the center and then the electrons are circling around the nucleus at different orbits. Now, that was actually a very unintuitive and it wasn't really predictable step. And it had to connect many sort of different strands of research that didn't seem really connected inherently, and that's what Bohr did. Just to mention one thing, he connected actually quantitatively the distribution of spectral lines in the experiments with the atomic spectra, which were supposed to tell us how the internal structure of atom the atom looks like, with his model, or more precisely with the distribution of these orbits of the electrons around the nucleus, extremely precisely. It was actually unprecedented precision in connecting the distribution of the orbits and the distribution of the spectral lines in these experiments, so-called Balmer series, that were connected with special rule with the distribution of the orbits. Now, how did he come up with this idea of the orbits and why are they interesting? Well, because he basically applied that Planck's quantization of energy that I mentioned earlier and basically said, well, actually, these orbits are not randomly distributed the way that Rutherford thought. The electrons are not sort of floating around the nucleus, because in that case, the atom would not be stable, but they're distributed according to the Planck's rule, actually. So the frequency of light that's absorbed in the atom and it's emitted is actually corresponds to the frequency with which electron is orbiting the nucleus. It was very simple, actually, to calculate. Very simple idea. I mean, once it was worked out, obviously, took him
years. Of course.
And then everybody was really happy that finally there was something tangible. Not everybody was happy with some of the properties of that model, but we won't go into that now. So the second contribution was the so-called correspondence principle. And usually it's presented as kind of the orbits that I mentioned, when you have a large number of these orbits in a very sort of a robust atom, if you want, or molecule, then your calculations your results for these radiation frequencies start to look like classical results. So as if you can basically approximate as if you are dealing with non-quantized atom or system, so to speak, very roughly and simplistically put. I mean, you're a physicist, so you're aware that I am approximating here for our audience. So just to mention then, what was very helpful is that you could use the classical tools, theoretical tools to account for these atomic systems, let's say, qualified by large quantum numbers. Now, what was particularly interesting to me, and I sort of dedicated one of the chapters there, is that it really, the way that it was also kind of a controversial principle as well among Bohr's peers, but very useful. They couldn't really sort of make progress in many areas of quantum mechanics at the time without it. But it really showed that he was always trying to mediate between the experiments and the theoretical, very abstract theoretical hypothesis, like his sort of a model of the atom was, and very kind of fairly simple, almost mundane experimental results in the experiments. And this was sort of the correspondence principle had that sort of a role. And then finally, if we sort of forward some 10 years after this, after many other experiments and theoretical breakthroughs, and the work of Heisenberg and Schrödinger and other physicists, Bohr tried to connect actually, I mean, typically it's presented again in textbooks as a sort of a wave-particle duality in the textbooks. Now, in a way, Bohr is responsible for this because his view was that the particle properties, or what seemed like particle properties of radiation and matter, or sort of pieces, elementary pieces of matter, and wave properties are kind of complementing each other. They are not contradicting each other. So the matter, or basic elements of matter, and radiation are not something that has to be either particle or wave, but can be something in between. Again, very, very sort of simplistically put. And then that was also kind of controversial, maybe the most controversial of his three breakthroughs, I would say.
And you discuss this kind of controversy that was born in the book a lot, and you also describe some of his biggest contenders with this principle. I was going to ask, how did his approach to quantum phenomena interact with those of Heisenberg and Schrödinger, like big names at the time in physics?
What I was really interested in is what led Bohr to come up with the results that seemed inescapable and extremely useful to everybody, and yet people complained about the nature of these results. So, for example, the main complaint about his model was that, well, how can electron, when the atom actually absorbs energy or a photon, and then electron is supposed to jump to the this orbit of sort of higher orbit, higher energy level. What are these? I mean, it's completely unintuitive. People complained that there are these quantum jumps, right? That nature can't work in terms of these quantum jumps, right? Then the complaint about his correspondence. I mean, there are other complaints, but nobody, nobody denied that his model is the best and can be used actually to make sort of progress, right? And that it has incredible agreement with the experimental results. And then the correspondence principle was also, like, his peers were puzzled. Those who actually used it, like, for example, Sommerfeld, who complained, well, you know, how did you come up with it? Is this part of quantum theory? Is this something that you cooked up somewhere in your dream, or what's going on? And then he would try a different solution, which he thought was intuitive. He would fail and then say, well, yeah, I can't really do without correspondence principle, but man, it's really annoying. So, and then finally, with his complementarity, all the sort of hell broke loose, and people, even nowadays, philosophers, physicists complain that it's really vague and obscure. What does it mean that your sort of elementary pieces of matter are both particle and wave, and these properties complement each other? What are we dealing with here, really, in physical terms, right? So I was thinking, okay, they kind of have a point, right? The main problem was, though, that one of the readings of how he came up with this was that he was really keen to push certain metaphysical views, sort of duality between, you know, mind and matter, and then he, by analogy, thought of duality of matter and waves and particles, and that's how he arrived. So it was metaphysically driven, and he was really metaphysically driven to discontinuities, even in his when he constructed his atom. And so that was really the main source, as far as I could see, of disappointment and kind of dissatisfaction with his with the, what was perceived as sort of incoherence of his model and his principles, right? That he was...
He had like a philosophical agenda to push.
It's basically as if he was pushing a philosophical agenda. And you can find, I mean, he was very broadly educated person, and he was involved in... he read philosophy, he talked to philosophers, debated with them at the time, and it was really characteristic of other physicists at the time, too. He was not alone in that. Schrödinger was also very inspired by philosophy, but sort of drew very different conclusions. But the main point is that he actually, when you look at what he did, he didn't really do that. His metaphysical sort of views and his comments would come at the very end of his work, once he figured out the result, once he figured out the principle, or once he figured out the model of the atom. The way he did it was actually sort of a bottom-up approach, starting with the experimental results and trying to reconcile them. And that's what he was trying all along. And that was if there is a Niels Bohr's method, I think there is, that's what he actually did. Very sort of a slow climb from the experimental results, putting in the brackets and kind of really trying to forget about all the metaphysical ideas and different metaphysical notions before you actually construct the model and the results. Then you can try to kind of clarify with the help of these various ideas. So I think many people got it sort of backwards. And then once you actually see that he was a kind of a staunch empiricist, kind of an inductivist, trying to induce his models and principles from the experimental work, then you realize this is why his models are... So this is why people who actually care about coherence of these models in sort of philosophical terms, in metaphysical terms, will not be happy with the result. It's nothing new, really, in the history of science, actually. Whoever preferred that kind of method, sort of inductive method, where you build slowly hypotheses from bottom up, is bound not to satisfy the wishes of those who are really keen to have like a very kind of a neat and polished metaphysical, sort of metaphysically satisfying model. So that's what was really kind of going on. And then Schrödinger, that you mentioned, I mean, we just mentioned that. Schrödinger had a very, very different way of doing physics. And one of the points in the book is that this is one way, one trajectory, one method that Bohr practiced. Other physicists are, you know, have very different approaches. You know, they go sort of from very abstract models to the phenomena, and that's fine. It works sometimes. Sometimes Bohr's method is more successful, But really what was interesting about that whole community of early quantum physicists is that they sort of battled, not only in terms of their theoretical models, but the ways in which you actually arrive to these models. And then Schrödinger was really sort of the exact opposite of what Bohr was doing at the time, just sort of having kind of a red lines, almost philosophical red lines that couldn't be crossed in when you're trying to come up with a model, when you're trying to come up with a physical explanation or formulas, even formalisms. And that's what they debated actually a lot.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you talk about how he builds the hypotheses bottom up. There's a bottom up construction in everything that he does. Could you talk a little bit about how he builds these hypotheses and what is a master hypothesis?
So again, I mean, I looked at Bohr because he's really sort of a prime example of this. But in a way, my sort of main goal was to understand at least one episode in the major episode in the development of quantum mechanics and physics, generally speaking, and to figure out how this sort of way of inducing these very abstract models works, right? So there are sort of three levels of hypotheses which are interconnected as the theory is actually produced. So the lowest level is the experimental level. These are sort of very local in a way, focused on phenomena, experimental hypotheses. And usually the experimental physicists are coming up with these. They just want to explain certain patterns that they see. They build more precise equipment and they improve these, and then they debate it among each other. One of the really great examples of this was early spectroscopy, which was one of the key results for Bohr's model of the atom. So they debated about various patterns that you get when you actually analyze the spectrum of hydrogen or helium, or these sort of simple atoms. And these controversies lasted 10, 15 years, right? So these experimental hypotheses are, in that sense, very local and focused on particular phenomena. And then you have scores of these different hypotheses. It's not always clear how they're connected, whether they're connected at all, right? Different sort of light scattering of light, for example, along with the spectroscopy, scattering of light at different frequencies and so on. And then there is kind of a medium level hypothesis where a certain properties which are kind of general and apply across these, or can be inferred across these seemingly different experiments and experimental hypotheses, kind of start emerging, right? So it was fairly clear, for example, from these spectroscopic results of the spectroscopy, that there are certain elements of atoms which are kind of constant, right? So physicists were not for a long time clear what these are. And then, but they understood there are, they call them terms, right? So there's something that's kind of constant across these and that produces always these stable results in spectroscopy. But then it took a much sort of a more abstract hypothesis or really models of the atom. And that's what I call actually master hypothesis that really unifies these seemingly disparate experiments through these intermediate hypotheses, where physicists actually said, well, these little constant parts are actually electrons or negative charges. And this is how they are actually related to the positive charge. And this is what the structure is. So they tried the different master hypotheses, but sort of emerging from these experimental results and these local experimental hypotheses at the local level. And then Bohr was really master in a sense of doing this. He was really always careful and constantly in touch with experimentalists from very different sort of, at the time, seemingly different areas of work and studying seemingly different phenomena and trying to connect this all the time and looking at the best ways to actually connect this. So this is what I would call sort of inductive hypothetical model of figuring out or sort of coming up with a physical theory and sort of at some fairly general abstract level.
That's fascinating. That's so cool. So in the book, you also talk about how some of the critics have described Bohr as an anti-realist because they interpret his writings wrong. What is an anti-realist and why did they think he was one?
Yeah, I mean, again, Bohr, I mean, to be fair, Bohr was a kind of a difficult writer, right? He wasn't somebody who would write sort of easily and, you know.
A lot of physicists
flamboyantly,
were.
Yes. But so there are certain aspects where you could think that he was anti-realist. Anti-realism is sort of a view in philosophy where, I mean, there are various kinds of anti-realism, as one might imagine, but very roughly, realists are those who believe that posits in the theory, for example, when you say electrons or atoms, correspond more or less to something out there in the nature, and we kind of identified that particular kind of entity or property with our theory that exists out there. Now, you can believe that physical theory doesn't really tell you that. It just is sort of a tool that, or sort of a construct that agrees with your experimental results. Whether there is something further on in the nature that corresponds to that is the question we can never really address. And, you know, science doesn't really is not meant to address that. What's important is that you have agreement with experimental results, with your observations, careful experimental observations or results of experiments. And then in that sense, anti-realists would say, well, you know, it's not the business of the science, scientific theory to tell us what how the world really is, but to come up with the theories that agree with our experiences.
And it's what's called colloquially the shut up and calculate approach.
That's kind of the later version of that sort of a philosophical attitude that people would say is not philosophical because they're kind of used to it. But it's exactly that, right? Just do your, you know, calculations, see whether it agrees with the experiments and leave these philosophical questions for philosophers, and, you know, don't waste time with that. That
right.
came later, right? And then typically, very often, Bohr is blamed, actually, for this. Now, what's interesting is the first thing that's interesting, Bohr didn't really calculate that much, actually. Much of his atom and model of the atom and later versions were results of really sort of intuitive leaps. And there is clear evidence for that. And everybody around him knew that he's not really big on math the way that some of the younger physicists at the time were. So he was certainly not the one who would say, shut up and calculate, right? I mean, he of course calculated, but he really wanted kind of agreement between the physical model that he produced, certain properties of it, and the experimental results. He was almost like an experimental physicist in that sense. And then he was really aware of this kind of anti-realist attitude that Heisenberg at the time was kind of flirting with. He was more of an instrumentalist, so that theories are instruments for prediction and nothing more than that. They don't tell us anything about nature, nor do we really care about that. And then he explicitly denied that in his correspondence, actually. So it's fairly clear when you read kind of a sort of more synoptically what Bohr was doing, that that was not his mission to push the kind of anti-realist philosophical agenda at all. He was, if anything, he was kind of inductivist, wanted like agreement with the experiments, but was deeply interested in what really that theory, quantum theory that's emerging, is telling us about the nature of physical properties. And he would reflect on that. So it's fairly, when you take that into account, I think it's really fair to say that he wasn't an anti-realist in any sort of a strong sense of the word, especially if it wasn't really pushing that agenda at any cost onto others.
Definitely. You mentioned a little bit of his correspondence with Heisenberg, and in the book it's very clear that you took a fine comb and look at all of his notes and all of the available correspondence. Tell me a little bit about the process of putting all of that together, all of these historical sources and his papers and all of the notes.
The book like this, the one that I wrote, couldn't actually have been written before all the collected works of Bohr that were published one volume after another since sort of a beginning of the 70s, early 70s, were slowly sort of redacted and came out. So that was the first, and they're really sort of invaluable source because all the correspondence there, all the versions of papers and so on. So, I mean, as one could imagine, I sort of took a long time. I worked on this for about 20 years overall and publishing papers and trying to sort of connect the dots and really triangulating between what historians said, what the correspondence says, what philosophical interpretations had to say, what other people said about Bohr, his peers, and so on. So, I mean, I really had to, if I wanted to sort of seriously undertake a task of understanding what Bohr, what motivated Bohr, what sort of methodology drove his work, I really had to connect all these dots. And I mean, predictably, it had to take a long time to do this. But I started it fairly early. Basically, when I started my graduate studies, I couldn't stop working on it. I'm still fascinated by that episode in the history of physics.
So the book lives at this intersection of history, philosophy, science. How do each of these influence the other, in your opinion?
So there is kind of a two big streams in philosophy of science and philosophy of physics, philosophy of science more generally. One is more interested in, people who do that are interested in sort of conceptual puzzles in particular theories, for example, in a general theory of relativity or in quantum mechanics, trying to figure out certain or to kind of perfect certain notions which figure in these theories. And it's very valuable work. And it's kind of dominant, actually. But then there is also sort of philosophically motivated reading of history of certain episodes in physics, where you try to figure out certain methodological and epistemological questions by really carefully reading history. And then you kind of have to read historians and to be, in a sense, historian, but with this sort of a motivation to address particular philosophical, methodological questions. So this is, you kind of have to keep an eye on both philosophical and historical concerns, but that's what makes it really interesting and valuable. And that's sort of, for me, that's the natural way actually to do it.
A lot of physicists kind of wave their hands and say that philosophy of science isn't really that important to them. Famously, Feynman said that philosophy of science to scientists is basically like ornithology to birds. And I don't necessarily agree with that comment, and I was wondering what your take on it is. What can physicists learn from studying Bohr's views and approach?
So this relationship between physics and philosophy is very interesting. In the last 100 and 120 years, it sort of fluctuates. There are periods of convergence and divergence, and now we are in the period of convergence, I would say, over the last 20 years. And physicists talk to philosophers, some at least, really sort of theoretical physicists dealing with fundamental, sort of foundational stuff. It really also depends what sort of philosophy of physics is done. So as far as this famous remark goes, that philosophy of science is what to physicists what ornithology is to birds, I mean, it's kind of true. But that in a sense, it's irrelevant, I would say, because ornithologists, when they study birds, they are not really trying to improve what birds do, you know, to improve how they fly and teach them.
That's a very good point.
About their trade, but they can tell us all kinds of interesting things and have really interesting and very important sort of consequences. So, for example, you know, we can preserve certain kinds of birds when we learn more about them. We can find out whether they are low flying, whether they are high flying, you know, how to connect our environment with them so we don't affect them. And I think that's one of the ways in which actually history and philosophy of physics and science in general can be helpful, because physicists do not really make their decisions, what they're going to study and how they're going to structure, for example, their teams and labs, how they're going to be funded. These are kind of larger societal decisions, government decisions, and so on. So you can screw up the physicists' work in all kinds of ways if you fund them poorly, if you organize them poorly, and so on. If you really interfere, so it's very important to have a clear view on what physicists are doing, how exactly, and when, in what environment, large environment, they are at their best, right? So one of the very important, I think, ways in which studying history and sort of philosophically studying physics, more sort of epistemologically, is to find out precisely this. I mean, physicists do that to an extent, but, you know, they have their daily work and interests. They can't really deal with that. Sometimes they have. But in that sense, I think that history and philosophy can be very informative and helpful, actually, to physicists and physics community. And understanding history is crucial, actually, of physics. Crucially understanding what actually physicists are doing.
You've spent so much time on working on this book and also researching Bohr's work. What are you working on now? What's next in terms of writing, in terms of teaching?
I've been for the last maybe a year or so co-writing a book on a quite different topic, actually, still physics, but a completely different area, modern cosmology, actually. Cosmology basically since the discovery of the cosmic microwave background as the kind of the milestone in modern cosmology. So it's going to be a book with one of the major publishers. And what we are trying to do in the book is to show that this very simplified view that the Big Bang, hot Big Bang more precisely, model didn't immediately win when the cosmic microwave background was discovered. That it was a very slow process that took many, many alternative views that were developed in the decades following the discovery all the way to the 2000s, basically by major physicists or cosmologists at the time. Some of them actually were the key physicists in developing the Big Bang, but they worked on these alternative views, which are completely fascinating, actually. What physicists came up with, what kind of alternative views. I mean, more famous is Hoyle's stationary state model, but there are all kinds of other very interesting. So this is also interesting for us to understand how in reality these big theories that we need in the end are actually developed and how they're helped by all sorts of alternative views which are in the meantime sort of developed. So that's the book we are working on at the moment.
That's very exciting. I look forward to reading it. Well, thank you so much, Professor. It was lovely to have you on this episode.
Thank you, Anna.
To all of our listeners, you can find From Data to Quanta online and in bookstores now. I hope it intrigues you and makes you ponder the nature of scientific inquiry, as well as appreciate or question the stories we tell about great scientists and their discoveries.